when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Starting On Podcast, Series 2, Episode 1 of the Starting On Podcast with me, Rich Lee. Today, I'm speaking to Brian Cox, the incredible Scottish actor Brian Cox. We talk about everything from his upbringing through to his remaining ambitions and everything in between. And I think the one thing with Brian is he is not backwards about coming forwards with his opinions, as many of you might know. So expect a lot of that. It's a fantastic conversation. And I think to give you the measure of a man in a sentence, when asked once if he felt like he put himself in too vulnerable a position, he said, "Listen, I'm too old, I'm too tired, and I'm too talented for any of that shit." Which, when you meet him, you realise, yeah, you know, I could totally see you saying that. There is a whole first series for you to discover and enjoy wherever you find, subscribe to, listen to your podcasts. There were some incredible guests in that first series. In my bid to talk to incredible people about their stories and perhaps even learn something about myself, I spoke to 3 OBEs, 1 MBE. I spoke to world champions, world record holders, Olympic medal winners, multi-millionaire entrepreneurs, philanthropists, people giving back just in incredible ways. And there are plenty of guests. I'll be very, very surprised if you look through series one, you don't find somebody that you'd like to listen to and hear their story. We started out last year and a good few episodes charted in the top UK interview podcasts alongside personal favourites and inspirations like Desert Island Discs and Louis Theroux. I'm hoping to do more of the same. My aim for this podcast is to make it one of the leading interview podcasts in the country and the world. I would love to get these fantastic guests and their stories out to as many people as possible. So if you are an agent and you have a potential guest that you'd like me to speak to, actors, entrepreneurs, entertainers, philanthropists, people with interesting stories, it is the starting line. Go to the website, startingonpod.com, and find out more about the podcast and me there and my background, I guess. If you are a potential guest yourself and you don't have an agent but you want to get in touch, email me, hello@startinglinepod.com. Agents, potential guests, get in touch there. Also, potential sponsors. If you want to sponsor an episode, if you want to sponsor this series, then please do get in touch. I think and hope this goes really, really well. And I want to find brands and sponsors that align with that, that the notion of success and resilience and overcoming challenges and perseverance and motivation and, you know, all those good things. You can find out more about the show by following us on social media. Go and share some things. That's at Starting Line Show on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. And that's Starting Line Podcast on Facebook and even LinkedIn, if that is your thing. All that remains to be said is, without further ado, I bring to you my interview with the incredible, the one and only Brian Cox.
Should billionaires exist? Should a person be able to accumulate a billion of anything?
If they do, they do. I mean, it's just what they do with that billion. You know, it's how they deal with the world. It doesn't deal with the world if you're kind of somebody like Elon Musk, you know, who's got no sense of proportion. That's also to do with his conditioning, because he is autistic. You know, so there is an autistic condition in Elon Musk, which stops him understanding certain things. He's a high-functioning autistic, which is difficult anyway. But it's because he gets absolute. So he will tell his advertisers to go and fuck themselves, you know. And you go, that isn't a good way of business, you know, which is why Twitter is, or X is doing that,
yes.
You know, because he's not a lot, you know, he's really not understanding it. And it's just how you serve the world, whatever, you know, should billionaires exist? Maybe eventually they won't, hopefully, but they do exist. And you have to deal with the reality. And you have to deal with how organically that's going to shift and how you deal with your billions. Unfortunately, we're still sort of sprogs. You know, we're still those sprogs. We're not grown up. We haven't grown up. We're still, you know, we're not even beyond the baby stage in our existence. You know, human beings are so fucked, basically. Basically, they're fucked. And they have been, and they're not doing anything about it, and they'll continue to be fucked because they're so stupid, really. That's the thing about humanity, is it's so deeply, deeply stupid. You look at Gaza, you look at what's happening there, you look at the appalling thing that's happening there, and you know they'll sort it out, but it's never going to go away because of belief systems which don't serve. They don't serve equanimity, you know, Muslim, Jew. It's all about this notion of God, that the idea that there's a God that takes care of us all. There's no such thing. Doesn't happen. That's not what it's about. It's about us, and we don't examine ourselves nearly enough. We don't look at who we are. We're always looking outside of ourselves instead of looking inside ourselves. And of course, the great thing about my job is that's what you have to do. You have to look inside yourself.
I was going to say, I think we live with fiction all around us, and for thousands of years now, we've told us our stories and believed stories. And,
yeah, exactly.
And it was, you know, the God of the gaps is the kind of theory I prescribe to, which is when people didn't know what wind was, of course it's a God. When people don't know what thunder is, of course it's a God. You know, and then all those God of the gaps. You know, I think religion has been used where there was no understanding.
Well, that's when we don't understand, we blame it on some outside force, you know. And we just realize that it's a force which is beyond our understanding, and we just have to accept it. And then perhaps we should start to understand ourselves, and we don't. We simply don't begin to understand ourselves, not when we have these belief systems that lead us into all kinds of horror, you know. And we've seen it, you know, we've lived through it. We've lived through the pogroms of the Jews in Russia. We've lived through the Holocaust. We're living through what's happening now in Palestine. We're living through what's happening in Ukraine, you know. And it's again and again the same faults and the same things are being repeated time and time again because we're stuck in belief systems which do not serve. And they do not serve because it's some kind of ideology that is never realized in a way, you know.
Do you think we're ever going to get to a place where we're not fighting each other over narratives?
No, because I think, unfortunately, we're not intelligent enough to realize it. You know, there are, of course, we've had the movements of, you know, the embracing of certain things which have a basis in Indian culture, Buddhism, you know, all the isms that so-called liberate us, but they're just isms. They're not actually about who we are. Mm. They're about who we could be or who we think we might be or what we may be possible of. But we don't deal with our own confusion. We tend to put our confusion out there instead of saying, what is it we're confused? That's why I do what I do. That's what acting is about. Acting is about understanding the human dilemma, understanding how all these systems ultimately fail you. And there might be one thing that gets you through that keeps you sane, you know, because that the other thing is that we're all kind of dealing with, and certainly I've lived with it in my time with my dear old poor Ma, is the nature of insanity, the nature of how we go mad and how it's easy to go mad. But if you really examine who we are and think about who we are and consider who we are and consider who you are, mainly who you are, you don't go mad. You just... And that's what's so great about my job. That's what my job does. And it's what Shakespeare says. He says, he calls it holding the mirror up to nature, that we reflect things back to the rest of humanity. That's why the theatre of all the churches, the theatre to me is the one true church, because it's the church of humanity. It's people dealing with all those things that we're dealing with every day and all those false gods that we create for ourselves. And the notion of the word God anyway is a sort of, it's a conceit. It's a terrible conceit that we don't really acknowledge, you know, in the way that it should be acknowledged. And I mean, I understand it. I understand what, you know, how you make, you know, how you reassure children at a very early age about everything's going to be all right. And then you lead to stories of certain things. But it's not helpful.
I think I take great solace in knowing that I don't matter. I know that's a tiny, like, it's potentially an odd thing to say, but we are so infinitely small. I think to love and be loved, I know it sounds really corny, but that's the most important thing for me is,
yes,
you know, to have the impact I can have on the people, you know, however big like community of people ends up being. When you were young, what did success look like to you at that point? Because to me, it looked like getting up and out. It looked like success to me was breaking a cycle. At a young age, I knew that was the case because you know what it's like with families, they repeat.
Well, I see it very clearly in my brother's family, you know. I mean, they you know, they're sentient beings, so you don't want to you can't dismiss anybody, and you can't, you know, you can only look at people's, how they've arrived at certain follies, but then it's what the world is around you. Mm. There is so much, you know, to be religious about it in a way, there's so much temptation. There's so much that wants to take you away from who you are. Mm-hmm. And in many ways you want to do that instead of actually thinking, well, what is it? It's like, I live with mental illness. So I saw my mother get mentally really doolally, you know, she had a complete mental breakdown. So I saw what the burden of that was. And that's all to do with her sense of faith, her sense of belief, and how that all was failing her, and how she came to feel really very negative about everything. You would say she recovered. I don't think she recovered. I think she just accepted what her religious faith had told her, rather than just say, no, be an agnostic, be a heathen, that's fine. You know, just go with that. If that's really what you're afraid of, you know, but we've got this notion of that salvation comes later. Mm-hmm. You know, the salvation is at the end of the road. And you go, we should be in a permanent state of salvation. We should be saving ourselves constantly. You know, we should be retreading certain things that we just take for granted. And that's what my job is about. You know, my job is about holding the mirror up to nature and saying, this is man, this is woman in their nakedness and also in their innocence and in their ignorance, you know, and we have to accept that innocence and ignorance and realize, and that's where we are. We're at a state of evolution. We haven't evolved. We simply have not evolved. And until we get our whole houses in order, we will not evolve. We will continue making the same mistakes until eventually we either destroy ourselves. And if we do destroy ourselves, we'll destroy ourselves because we deserve to be destroyed.
Well, they say, don't they? Everything on the planet now is only 1% of everything that's ever existed. So how and why should we be different? You know, at some point that might happen. You look at developments in AI, there's every chance that we do ourselves out of existence.
Well, we develop these things, but we develop them with the understanding of the relate to our core, to the core of who we are. We go, this will help us. But we don't understand what it is that we are dealing with.
It's recognizing that, you know, actually, we don't matter that much. And also being okay with that. How conceited to think that I deserve a place in a heaven, you know, where, you know, 7 billion people on the planet. And, you know, I don't think people can, and this is where social media comes in for me as well. And with, you know, ill mental health trends and things like that run out, I don't think we're evolved enough yet to comprehend that there are 10 people just like me somewhere else in the world. I just don't think that we are ready to, as a society, understand the ramifications of instant access to all of the world all of the time.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. We don't understand because we are basically stupid.
It's a theme.
No, we are stupid.
How old were you when your mum went through that? It was just after your dad passed away?
Yeah, I was nine, so between the ages of 9 and really 13, I had to deal with.
I was a similar. My mum had something of a breakdown when her mum passed away, and she was blamed for her mother's passing, and she had an incredibly difficult time. And it's exactly as you say, you know, you watch a person breaking down and losing themselves entirely. And that
why was she blamed?
Because it was quite a violent upbringing. Her mum was constantly asking her to, she wouldn't leave because she was afraid we'd be taken into care and all those things. So her mum and her had this big blazing row. And then her mum at 52 had a heart attack and passed away. And because of this row, and my mum's not an arguer, but she and her mum had this disagreement or upset. And my mum's dad blames her for his wife's passing, saying effectively, you made that happen. And that's grief. That's grief talking. But it's that unrepentant. He's recently died.
Also, it's ignorant.
It's absolutely ignorant.
It's profoundly ignorant.
My mum couldn't deal with it. Life was hard as it was. You said money is a demon in your life, or has been, and we felt that profoundly. And you said that there's an indignity in being poor. You are the product, as you rightly said earlier on, of your upbringing, but that doesn't have to solely define you.
No, not at all.
So me asking about success then, success at that time would have looked very different to what success possibly now looks like to you.
Yeah, I mean, success was just doing what I wanted to do. You know, because I always knew what I wanted to do. And my thing, the other ironic thing about all of that is I never felt anything. I just was getting on with it.
Exactly.
You know, I never felt, I don't remember crying a lot or anything or feeling. I mean, I cried, of course, when my dad died. And the extraordinary thing that happened to me when my mother passed, I was in Nottingham, and it was 1973, and I was already in my late 20s. I was 27, or coming up to being 27. And I remember I had a sort of night, and I was staying in a sort of hotel restaurant, one of those bar hotels in Nottingham. And there was a knock on the door in the morning, and the police came to tell me. And I'd had a restless night. And the police had come to tell me that my mother had passed away. And I remember the sense of relief that I felt that my mother had gone.
On her behalf or
no,
yours.
On my behalf.
Really?
I felt, oh, I'm free. I felt I'm free. And
How do you reflect on that now? Do you feel like that was a fair?
Yeah, I think it was absolutely fair. Because I'd been subjected to dealing with my mother and dealing with her in the way I could, which was fine. You know, I just dealt with it. But then the relief, and I felt guilty about that relief because it was my mom. You know, I was sad, but I was relieved.
Yeah.
I realized that burden had been taken away from me.
Very similarly, we got a knock on the door. My uncle had taken his own life. He was a heroin addict. And I felt a genuine instant relief on his behalf. Of course, as you say, it's upsetting. But then you think, well, that person's life wasn't a joyous one. There wasn't happiness. I look at his life and I think, well, you know, he'd jump out the first floor window to go and score. And, you know, so my dad would, he was his brother, would try to keep him from going and getting anything, and it wouldn't work.
Is that how he killed himself?
He overdosed.
Oh, you overdosed. So when you jumped down the front
door? He'd jump out the window. You know, my dad would lock him in a room to stop him from going out and scoring, and he'd still find a way because addicts do. But
you could have killed himself jumping out of a window, mind you.
I look back and I laugh now, but equally, there was a relief. And you do feel guilty for having that sense of relief. But for me, it wasn't on my behalf, it was for him. I thought, well, now you don't have to live quite so unhappily. And I guess your mum was incredibly unhappy.
No, she wasn't unhappy. I mean, no.
At that time in her life.
I mean, she lost for a while and she got it back, which I thought was unfortunate. But she lost her faith for a while and then she got it back. And of course, I think you go back to any sort of twig that's possible to get you out of the water, you know, that you can hang on to. And that twig happened to be her faith. And it worked for her. And she was perfectly, I mean, it's hard to tell how happy or unhappy she was. But all I knew was my sense of relief that I didn't have that burden anymore, that was clearly, and I hadn't realized I felt that way about my mum, that it was something, you know. And I remember when I was a student, she wanted to come and look after me in London. She said, I'll come down, we'll move in, we'll get a place in London. And that was the worst idea ever. You know,
also, as a student, nobody wants to live with their mum.
No, I didn't want to live with my mum at all, you know. So I said, no, mum, it's not a good idea, you know. And I persuaded her not to do that. And I think my sisters helped with that as well. And it's a hard thing because when you're little, you're so dependable on your mum. You go everywhere with your mum. You go to the toilet with her, you know. I even remember one of my memories is being in the toilet at about, probably less than maybe two. And my mum's sitting on the loo, and I remember her legs. So I remember sitting down there. So that was a kind of memory of that my dependability, that I couldn't even let her go to the toilet on my own because I needed to be with her when I was a child. And, of course, you have that relationship. It's that bond that you have, and women have it more than men. Men don't have it. Men have no sense of that whatsoever in relationship to their children. You know, they don't feel that way, that the physical thing. And you feel it too because this is where you came from. Mm-hmm. This is where that creature is the creature you came from. And so that never leaves you in a way. That's still there, that symbiotic relationship that you have with your parent, your mother particularly. And when that goes, you do feel, oh, there is a relief in that. Mm. I don't have that burden of responsibility anymore where I can't help her. I couldn't help her. I was not able to help
that
her.
That is the thing, because money doesn't do it.
No.
Money doesn't do it. You know, and I've very much felt that. And that's, as I said, all I can get to is about control, and it's about having the ability to recognize your own agency. And the second that you stop making excuses, and the second you think, okay, everything that happens to me, like, I have some degree of control over, I guess it's me searching for a difference. It's me searching for a point of difference as to why I'm not.
But the thing is, this idea of control, we have no control.
Do you not believe so?
No, not at all.
Did you not see the success
you
had?
try and make as much as you can, but you're not ultimately not in control
because of variables,
because of just the business of being alive. Being alive is not being in control. Being, you know, you look at the trees and you go, the trees, all right, there's a rhythm to them. You know, now I can see the hill because the leaves are off, and I love it when it's in the winter because I can see the hill. But the rest of the year it's full, and that's part of the conditioning. And of course, the conditioning with a parent is much more complicated than that. It is not as regulated as that. It's much more catch as catch can, you know. But you don't have control over it, and you don't. And it's that idea that we can control. We can't. We allow our lives to flow, and we can direct it. We can create the tributaries by which it flows down. But ultimately, you can't control it.
I guess that's all I clung to, is the notion of maybe direction is a better way of putting it. You know, like that I can direct in a direct. You know,
well, I think so. I know that I'm not in control. You know, I know that because of what's going on. You know, because of the way I'm recognized, the way people. I mean, I can't help that people come up and say, "Can you tell me to fuck off?" That's their problem, not mine.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not in control of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've played somebody, and that's the identification that people have in their heads. And it's also, I think, where we are in our state of evolution. We have not evolved. We are not evolved. You know, we are simply not evolved enough, or we wouldn't be doing the stupid things that we're doing constantly, right, time and time again, that we've done in the last, you know, time immemorial.
With Succession, then, I think people look at you and they will associate you with this, with, because of Logan Roy, with the grand wealth, with all that. Is it important to you that you speak to your upbringing? So,
I'm a socialist.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a socialist. You know, for better or for worse, I'm a socialist. And, you know, I'm also in socialism as it was practiced by the Labour Party and the, you know, where it got to, you know, the idea of New Labour. I was always suspicious of that idea anyway, though I did the broadcast for Labour in 97, and I did the whole campaign of Blair getting elected, and it was an amazing time. But he's, you know, we had to deal with his hubris, and we had to deal with what he's was incapable of, and it all kind of ended. And so social democracy got into a state, and I had to look at something particular. I thought, where am I going to go? Which is why I went back to my identity as a Celt, and how that had been subdued for so long in every aspect. And what's going on in Ireland now, what's happened, that, you know, the whole conflict in Ireland and how it's been dealt with, you know, that we've been subjects to this one idea. And now I believe no longer in that. I believe in independent, I believe in a federal state. I believe in a state, well, not a United Kingdom, because it's never been a United Kingdom. I believe that we should be federal, that each country should be autonomous, and that we should come together as a federation. Because if you look at the islands, you say, they're the islands there. And it just so happened this bunch of people arrived through traveling. The Celts arrived and they inhabited that whole area. But then they were finally subdued. And we have to get our own individual identities back and come together in a unity, in a proper unity, which has not existed ever in this country. Ever. You know, it really hasn't.
I mean, it's not getting any more united now, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. It's certainly not united, but it cannot be united under the present conditions. The conditions have to change.
Is there hope in that? Do you feel hopeful?
Well, I think there's hope because things do grow up. We all grow up and we all get old and we all die. So that's the, you know, that's the thing that you can really guarantee. But then you have to reflect that and the rest of the world. And you've got to say, well, the rest of the world has to, you know, that's the nature of what the world is. We're at a particular state of evolution. We haven't evolved enough. We have a vision of something. We can see something in the future, but we know it's not now.
Do you mean like multiplanetary existence? And
well, not just multiplanetary, just being human beings. Mm. Understand what our human potential is.
Do you think that religion holds us back?
Well, considerably, yes. I think religion does hold us back because it's belief systems which are outside ourselves. They're not dealing with who we are. We're dealing, well, if God says this and God does that, and you go, well, what is God? We've created that idea of God, and we've created it as a control issue. And it's also a patriarchal issue.
Which is exactly where it started, right?
Yeah, and that's how it started. And it's essentially patriarchal. Mm-hmm. We haven't given enough scope to the matriarchy. And I think, you know, we need to move matriarchally. We have to go more towards a matriarchy because the mothering thing is the thing which is the real conditioning of our lives. Our fathers don't condition ourselves. They're too bloody selfish. But our mothers have to. Because they have an umbilical, you know, that's what the umbilical cord is about. They have, even though it's cut away, there's an umbilical relationship to your child. And the women have that. Men do not have that. They're just sperm banks, movable sperm banks to walk around and come and go, oh, yeah, well, yeah, actually, I don't go with that for a bit. And then you move on. Women don't do that.
How do we get to a more patriarchal society?
Well, we do because we have to honor them. And we have to give them their place. And we're resistant to that. Because all our, you know, it's Adam and Eve. Eve is, I mean, the propaganda goes right the way back. The Bible is one of the worst books ever, for me, from my point of view, because it starts with the idea that Adam's rib, you know, that out of Adam's rib, this woman was created. And they'll believe it, because they're stupid enough.
I guess people need it. People need to feel that there's something outside of themselves.
They don't need to be told lies. They need some kind of truth, and that is not the truth. It is not the truth. It's a mythology. You know, it's not really to do with what they women understand more than anybody.
Ricky Gervais has that thing he says where it's, you know, you believe in your God. I just believe in one fewer God than you. Out of the thousands of gods that have existed in you know, over the millennia, I believe in one fewer God than you do. And that's I take comfort in that, thinking, you know, if only we could all get to that kind of higher... I believe it sounds conceited. I believe it's a high level of thinking to do away with religion. I do.
I don't think it's so high. I think it's a level of understanding. I mean, I think
higher than killing somebody.
Well, it's higher than killing somebody and killing somebody in this needless pursuit of some kind of thing which doesn't serve us at all. And the cruelest thing are these children. The children that were slaughtered by Hamas. And then the more children that we, you know, it's well into the late thousands, probably gone beyond 5,000 kids now that we've been, and the unborn life, the in these hospitals. I mean, really, it's unbelievable that we do this and we stop for a week. Oh, yes, we'll stop for a week and let's negotiate and get the horses out. Even Hamas are going, well, it's all gone a bit too far now, hasn't it? I mean, people are so stupid. They are so stupid. and they cannot see the writing on the wall, you know.
Yeah. How do you reflect? It's been 6 months since the final episode of Succession out. I mean, you touched on earlier on people telling you asking you to tell them to fuck off and things like that. Is, you know, what does it mean to you now when you look back?
Well, it was a great job. I loved the job. I loved the work. I loved the cast. I loved the writers. It was perfect. You know, it was in every aspect. It was great. And it finished when it did. And I think it finished right. It didn't overstay its welcome. It didn't go past its sell-by date. It realized itself and it was bold, you know. Even my death was a very bold thing. I personally would have preferred a couple of more episodes.
Yeah.
I still got paid. That was the main thing. That was my main worry, was I did get paid. But I would, you know, I would have, you know, it was very sudden. But then that was the impact, you know. So that episode was kind of a shocking episode. And it
really was, wasn't it?
Shook everybody up.
Episode 3, wasn't it?
Episode 3, yeah.
I remember. But even then, the weight of your characters, even in the coffin, you feel that Logan Roy's there.
That was the strength of the role and the understanding of the role. And it was a great role because he was also, he was a flawed man, but he was not. He was a serious man. And he believed, you know, my favorite line in the whole show is when he says to the kids, I love you, but you're not serious people.
That's my favorite line as well.
Yeah, and because it's true, you know, they're not. It's about avarice, it's about greed, and that's not what he's talking about. You know, he's become right-wing, and we could argue with that, and certainly I would argue with that, but he's become right-wing for certain reasons, and reasons which are actually justifiable because of his sense of survival, sense of what he's, and also his endless disappointment. I mean, my feeling was that when he started, you know, he started as a journalist and he was probably left of center, but radically more and more everything changed and he shifted because he felt that nothing was being honored in that area. And therefore he decided to, you know, become more and more independent and therefore more and more.
I think that's what happens with success, isn't it?
You
begin to become more individualistic.
That's right. And you argue with the social imperative. But I think you do that at a huge risk. I mean, my belief is the social imperative. You know, we've got to get everybody on the same page. I mean, nobody will ever be on the same page, but at least there are too many other pages that we get lost in, yeah. You know, to not be focused on what we should be focused on.
So what truth are you bringing out through your portrayal of Logan Roy?
The thing about Logan was he was a self-made man. He was brutalist in his attitude, but also, and this was went right the way back, his one weakness, which should have been a strength, was that he loved his children. If he didn't love his children, he would have been things would have been a lot happier.
I was speaking to my partner about this, and she said, you know, do you think that Logan loved his kids? Well, absolutely. Absolutely, I got that impression.
No, he loves his children.
Yeah.
That's the thing. He loves them all, but he sees them as wrecks. And the person that he thought was going to be all right was his daughter, but she's proved to be a bigger wreck than anybody. But actually, if you think about it, from the end of episode 3 and the way he was going with Tom and how Tom was caring for him when he had these UTI, horrible UTI moment, and Tom actually showed some compassion. He acknowledges that compassion so that Tom becomes the heir. Mm-hmm. He becomes the heir apparent because he's like Logan. There's an innocence about him that gets caught in a violence and that sort of homoerotic relationship he has with Greg.
That's my other favorite line is, if you want to make a Tomlet, you got to break a few Gregs.
Yeah, that's right.
I think of that line probably more than is healthy. I just think that's such fantastic writing.
Yeah, I know. No, it's great writing. It's clever. It's very clever.
It's really, really good. Are you in touch with any of the cast still?
I haven't been, no. Sarah's about to open here, I think, in the play. I'll try and go and see that. I've just been too busy doing other stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to move on quickly, and I planned, even before the strike, I'd planned to go back to the theatre, you know, which I'm sort of questioning because I'm wondering if I can still remember my lines. It was tough for me doing the bath, let me tell you that. But
because of lines?
Yeah, because it was because we had no time to rehearse. You know, we had 4 weeks and the director would not cut it. He would not cut the play. And I just kept saying, I can't learn it until you cut it. And then he finally cut it 2 weeks before we opened. And,
right, so 2 weeks before you're still learning lines.
Yeah, you're still, and you're going, you know, and this is, and I need to be on top of it. I need to, I can't go on going, what am I going to try and say next? I've got to, it's got to have impetus throughout the evening. And that was the thing that really drove me nuts, you know, trying to make that happen.
Do you know what I did? I looked at all of your projects. There's 176 projects, films, TV, TV films, video games as well. And I guess something like Succession comes along and can be defining because, as you say now, you said you've lost your anonymity to a degree. I don't know how you had any anonymity anyway, given your projects previous to Succession.
Well, I suppose I didn't get as bothered by people as I, you know, people didn't, I mean, somebody would say, oh, I've seen you, you know, people, it was much more.
There was a kindness to it, maybe.
There was, yeah, it was much more, it was less hysterical than it's become, you know.
Hysterical?
Yeah, it's a bit hysterical now, yeah. You know, people going, oh, yeah, please, you know, can you tell me, when I take a photo, you know, you're Brian Cox, can I, you know, and you go, yeah, hi, bye, this is the shop, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, the one great thing is I've never been able to say the word no, and I have learned the word no really well. It's I think it's my Irish adherence, because in the Irish language, there is no word for no. Did you know that?
There isn't?
No, there isn't.
I did not know that.
No, they don't have a word for no. They in Gaelic, there's an Irish Gaelic, there's no word for no. It's and of course, you know, Irish will never say no. They're, oh, well, no. Ah, sure, but then again, ah, well, it could be, but then again, you know. You know, that's their way of negating something, you know.
That's fantastic. One of the things that made me want to do this was, do you remember James Lipton's Inside the Actors Studio?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely loved it. I think
they're great.
Beautiful.
They're great.
I love, and that's part of this for me is why people are who they are. And I think it's, is, as you say, an assessment of success and, you know, and all those things. Every single person I've spoken to, and we spoke to some fantastic people, it's never financial. It's never, I want this much money. It's always been financial security first, then.
No, money is
about the craft.
I mean, money's okay. I mean, I'm not knocking the money. But it's, and in a way it's great because it means that you don't have to worry in the same way that you worried before. But at the same time, you can't depend on it. You know, I mean, I'm too long at the wheel to depend on it because it can all evaporate very, very quickly, especially if you've got children and you've got schools and you've still, and I've got a second family and all of that, you know. And, yeah. And the avarice that goes with it.
Absolutely. So Lipton and Inside the Actor Studio is a big inspiration almost because it looks at the crafts of it. I'm surprised you got on there. I was looking back through the list. No.
I wasn't famous enough.
I mean, I think in, what was it, 2007, you were named, you know, one of the top British actors in Hollywood. So, you know, he was still knocking around for a long time after that. So
yeah, it just never happened. I'd love to have done James Lipton because, you know, I've got quite strong views on stuff. So I would have loved to have done that.
Yeah, I think he was just fantastic. But you mentioned in a chat with Emily Blunt, the Actors on Actors, you said that Meryl Streep's somebody you'd love to act with. Is there anybody else? Anybody else jump out? Before I snuff it, which was your line?
Yeah, I mean, Merle is certainly somebody. I'm going to be working with Patricia Clarkson, who's an actress I've always admired. And, you know, she's a slightly unsung hero, Patricia, and she's as capable as any actress I know. And I'm going to be doing Long Day's Journey into Night with her. And, you know, there's always, you know, I've been lucky, you know, there's always the new kids on the block, and they're always exciting to work with. And I'm working with a couple of new kids on the block, so I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Who's that?
The two lads are playing my sons. So, yeah, I like Robert De Niro and I like Al Pacino. I don't think I have any desire to work with them, but I like them. I mean, I wouldn't mind working with them, but Meryl Streep is somebody who is particularly extraordinary. I mean, I was very jealous of Meryl Streep when I was younger because I didn't quite believe her, and it was my fault. I was in the wrong.
You didn't believe.
I just kept saying she's too good. How can you be that good? You know, and I kind of questioned her ability because she was, and she is. I mean, she's humble and she's open, and you know, there's a sort of You know, there's a sort of, she's a real receptacle for the work, and I love that aspect. And I think, actually, curiously enough, I think Emily is probably going to go the same way, Emily Blunt. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed with the English that she did. Mm-hmm. I watched that show, I thought it was very good, and I really liked meeting her. I thought she was a very smart young woman, you know. And I think there are many actors that I would like to work with. Don't ask me to name any of them, but I can, I've been very lucky that I've worked with, you know, like I'd like to work. Actually, I'd like to be directed by, because he's a very fine director, and he's not directed nearly enough, is Stanley Tucci. Mm. You know, who I saw that wonderful film he made with Tony Shalhoub, where they played brothers and they had an Italian restaurant, which I think was set in Jersey. Can't remember the title of that film, but it was a brilliant film, and his direction was. And then he made another film later on, which was slightly more adventurous, didn't do as well. But he's a very fine director, Stanley. You know, a lot of actors are fine directors. I've worked with Ralph Fiennes as a director, who I love working with. I absolutely adore. Vanessa Redgrave is somebody who I would work with. Wow. Judi Dench, I would work with. I've been very lucky. I've had a great time with Eileen Atkins, who I just adore as an actress. So I've been very lucky. I've worked with a lot of great people over the years.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Talk about actors and directing. Glenn Rothen, how's that going?
It's going. You know, got to try and get the money. You know, it's, you know, we're trying to, having to be all things to all men or all things to all various possible investors, which is always tricky. And hopefully we'll get there. I think we are getting there. We've just done a new version and, you know, we've got Canal Plus involved and hopefully we'll get there. But it's touch and go. You know, I mean, it's very funny. I mean, you know, one of the problems you have is you set a film in Scotland and they say, well, we need names. And you go, Well, there aren't, you know, the names you can count on two hands in Scotland that would, you know, that would make films.
Yeah.
And even then it's questionable. And you want to make a film that tells you a story about your country and tells you a story, which is, I think, a great story. And it's hard to get the cast because they keep saying, can you get a name to play that part? And you're going, well, she's Scots, that part. And
you want to keep it.
And I want to keep it that way. Yeah. And that's difficult because you're in a compromised position straight away, you know, because you're saying, I would like a Scottish actress to play this. And they kept saying, well, you know, there's nobody with a name. And then you find a Scottish actress who's got the name and they don't want to do it. It's as simple as that. So
is it difficult being on the other side of the fence, I guess, being the person to put all of this together?
Yeah, it's a different ball game. You know, it really is a different ball game. And it's a good experience because you're experienced the real difficulties that people have of putting a film together. You know, it's not easy.
And as an actor, you generally kind of protected from that.
Well, you know, you're a hired hand and you're protected by the environment that you're in because you're already hired, so you don't have to worry about it. This is a different responsibility and it's a creative responsibility and it's a big job. It's a big job in that sense, you know, and because you're taking in everything, the visual aspect of it, and you're also start questioning your own worth because I've never directed a film before. You're thinking, well, you know, maybe I'm not very good, but I'll soon find out.
I mean, you've directed before. You directed, was it an episode of Oz?
I did. Yeah. I did do a directed episode
of Oz. How was that? That was...
It was great fun. I directed it, but I remember I was very nervous about it. And on the first morning we started, you know, and we started at 7 o'clock, and I think it was an episode where a guy gets thrown in a wheelchair, gets thrown down an elevator shaft. Or he's about to be thrown down an elevator shaft, but somebody else gets thrown down the elevator shaft. So that was the first scene we did. So at 20 past 7, I'm shouting, we're behind. And the first assistant's saying, Brian, we're not behind, we're still on time. That was my own nervousness.
Wow.
So, you know, that was an interesting, you know, an interesting show. And Tom trusted me, you know. I mean, they do the edit. They finally do what they want. You know, I mean, you get your edit and then they do their edit. And it's usually what the producer, you know, that directors in television aren't as powerful as they are in movies. They don't have the same power. They've got a much more, it's a much more limited power they have.
I guess you've achieved so much and clearly been incredibly active in 176 projects. I say, like, is there any, like, what do you feel you've got left to achieve? Is it directing? Is it? Because I know you don't care for a knighthood.
Pardon?
You don't care for a knighthood, is that
still
the case?
Oh, no, I don't. All that's bollocks. Or... You know, I'm not interested. I mean, I have a CBE, and I did that because my late sister was a royalist, and she loved the L things, Queen and Country, and I did it out of respect for her, and I was offered it, and I thought it was churlish to turn it down, but I made it clear that I don't want a knight, so I'm not ever going to be offered one, which is great, you know, because that would put me in a dilemma again, except I won't be in the same dilemma because I don't have, my sister's gone now, and my other sister isn't a particularly royalist, so that would be okay.
But did she appreciate that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think she realized I did it for her, but that she, you know, I think she was able to come, so she was able to dress up and come to Buckingham Palace and go through all that.
I spoke to a lady that founded Go Compare. And she's the same. She was not concerned at all. Her mum was like, you are going to bloody Buckingham Palace and you are getting that OBE, because she was the royalist in the family and Hayley couldn't have cared less. She went to Downing Street and she said disgraced herself, got pissed and ended up walking out with her heels in her hand. She's like, I don't care about meeting the Prime Minister, I'm just a business person, you know, and there's a wonderful humility to it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm never really bothered about that kind of thing, you know. We always, an expression, I mean, we, you know, even though Scotland has been tribal. It no longer is, but it's much more egalitarian than, you know, we're still so feudal here, everybody in their place, you know, and it doesn't change. And it's you know, America's bad enough from that other extreme of what Trump has done and the degree of selfishness that he's brought into the, you know, that everybody could be as selfish as they like, and of course it's not serving the country.
How do you think the next election goes?
What, this one?
Well, the US.
I don't know. I hopefully he'll be in jail. I still think Biden shouldn't run. I like Biden. I think he's a good man, but he is, you know, it's, I just think he has to understand that he's 80, you know, when he comes out, and he's 80 now, he'll be 81 when he's elected, and we're going on to he's 85. And, you know, given, even now, I'm in my mid-70s. I mean, I still find certain things a little hard, you know. I mean, and I'm pretty fit, you know. He clearly has been a runner in his life, and you can see the way he's walked. His knees are shot to hell, you know. His legs are gone, which is why he seems more frail than he is. I mean, his brain is good. He's got, and his heart is certainly very good, you know. So in many ways, I like the man, but I don't. I think this is too critical. We need someone younger. We need someone who is a visionary. You know, that's what America needs, vision. It needs positive vision. It doesn't need negative vision, which is only the only vision that the vision of vested interest is the vision of that Donald Trump will sell. So it doesn't need that. This country, on the other hand, is pathetic. It's pathetic in its every aspect. It's pathetic in its...
You were Prime Minister tomorrow, what do you change?
Everything.
It's a long list.
Well, I would certainly, if I was Prime Minister tomorrow, I would move for moving Parliament out of London for a start, moving it somewhere more sensible, where more, you know, where there's a better sense of equality. I mean, London is ridiculous for a you know, when you think about how much it costs to be here, how expensive it is, and how needless it is, because you can have a parliament anywhere. You know, you don't have to have it in London. But that's a minor thing.
Where would you have it?
You just probably somewhere like Wolverhampton.
So somewhere relatively central.
Yeah, that's where I'd have it. Somewhere like that in the Midlands, or probably around about that area, Birmingham, Wolverhampton area. You know, but also I think that we're still so feudal. We have these, we really have to make our monarchy much more constitutional than it is. It isn't constitutional enough. It kind of slides away into certain things. And though I think the Queen did an amazing job, I think she was an extraordinary woman. I can't fault that woman because she did a brilliant job. But also she came from the fact that it killed her father. So she wasn't particularly happy with the idea of being Queen. And she just did it. And she did it in a very clear way to her own sense. Whereas Charles does believe in the divine right of kings, and that is a nonsense as far as I'm concerned. The divine right of kings is something that's Shakespearean in its belief system, but it's outmoded. You know, there is no such thing as divine right, you know. The kings, because kings are basically, they all started as bandits anyway. That's what they were, so there's nothing divine about them.
I mean, as you say, it's just violence and conflict that keeps people
Exactly.
So you're not advocating for the kind of the breakdown of the monarchy. You're just saying that it's not fit for purpose as is.
It's not fit for purpose. And I do think that we need to move to a much more, where we are not in a feudal state, where we're not still metaphorically touching our forehead, because we still do that. And the Conservative Party continue those things. And then when you get an asshole or an idiot like Boris Johnson that shows the extreme of that, and goes, this is not good. And it's not good that this liar has been around, has done so much damage. And now we're finding out from Hancock and the COVID thing, and he's saying, oh, we should have started the COVID 3 weeks earlier. Oh, fine thing, after the event, saying, we wouldn't have lost so many people. And you're going, well, why didn't you? Why didn't you do something? Yeah. You know, why did you allow it? You know, and it's bad governance. And there's always this 13 years thing. That we have these bad governments for 30 years. I mean, when I was a kid, they talked about the Tory Party, when Harold Wilson got in with a majority of three in 1963, 64, I think it was. And he got in with a majority of three, we thought that was great. But we had had 13 years of Tory misrule. And we have had 13 years, and we keep having 13 years of Tory misrule because it's so retrograde. And it's all based on the south of England. It's all based on the economy of the south. It's got nothing to do with the rest of the world. That's why we need a proper federal system where everything is divided. England should be divided into the north and the south, and it should serve, the nation or a sense of nation. Because I look at the islands and I think, well, there we are. We are physically in relations. We're that thing there at the end of what was then the end of the known world, We should acknowledge that instead of the fact that we've had the way the Irish have been treated, the way, and subsequently the way the Scots have been treated, the way we lost our parliament, the ignorance that we lost it through, and the fact that out of that came the Scottish Enlightenment, then you had David Hume, Adam Smith, all these great thinkers, I'm hoping to do a play about Adam Smith at the Edinburgh Festival in 2025, because I just said we had this one. We've been talking to James Graham, and James is a brilliant, brilliant, one of the really fine writers we have at the moment. And I just said, I gave him the idea that what about dealing with the financial crisis of, and then Adam Smith suddenly pops up and says, "What's going on? What's happening?" And the fact that Thatcher, she appropriated Adam Smith all stuff that he had only hinted at, but he'd said no. I mean, at the end of the day, that doesn't serve. He was much more economical in his thinking, and and I just feel that this is something that is we have not looked at, so that we have this north-south divide, but we haven't looked at how do we integrate, how do we become part of a community that serves. Not by being separated, and the Scots are always being treated as the poor relation, And of course, the Irish, Ireland have got out of it, but they've still...
How the Other Half Live documentary, yeah. Looking at the food banks and you getting very obviously and visibly upset at the gap that is only increasing.
Yeah. And you went, we went through the 60s in order to avoid all that, to stop all that. And it hasn't stopped. It's got worse. And also from somebody like me coming into this profession, there are no pathways. I was with Lorraine Kelly yesterday, and Lorraine, is this wonderful kind of great, lovely creature, and sweet as anything. And she was saying the same. She said, nobody from my background could do what I'm doing now. It doesn't come from that. There's no chain that links you through, whereas there was in the 60s.
Is that just a lack of interest in the arts as a career?
No, it's a lack of interest in humanity, right? So it's not a lack of interest in the arts. Mm. It's a lack of interest in how we treat our people and how we give our people the opportunities which were there. Like the amount of grammar school boys who went to university in the 1950s.
Social mobility.
Yeah.
Exists. So I went to a grammar school. It's a selective school. I want to give me some self-worth if I can get it.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't exist anymore because the grammar school system is such that it's everybody is getting tutored. Everybody is, to pass and to get in. So everybody's coming from so far away. So my daughter went to one in Cheltenham. And you'd have people traveling for 2 hours to bring their kids to it, or their kids traveling for hours to get to it. And that's grammar schools in where I'm from, Gloucester, they tend to be in the more deprived areas. So those kids could look at that school and think, okay, well, if I'm bright enough, I can get in there. And that's not the case anymore. They're being passed over because
kids are coming from much further away. That's why we're not serving the community. We refuse to serve the communities, and we refuse to enhance the communities. To make them self-serving, make them, self-worth,
Yeah.
And this happens constantly. We our idea of governance has just become nonsense. And it doesn't work anymore. We got, and also our interference. I mean, the great thing about Blair was his, the whole Iraq thing. I mean, the whole Middle East thing, when he says on that program, he says, I didn't know it was going to go like that. He said, you should have fucking thought about it, that it was going to go like that. You don't go into something that you don't understand and start saying, dictating the odds, and then going along with George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, because it was all so corrupt, obviously corrupt. And the whole system was damaged. The whole system of the Middle East was just, and that's why we have Syria. That's why we have the conflict that we have. That's why we had the Islamic State arise. That's why all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where to go in terms of politics.
Well, no, it's very, very hard. But unfortunately, politics is the means by which we operate. Mm. And we have to have an operating system that works. And so far, none of it works.
Did you ever have any interest in... Did you ever have any political aspirations?
Well, people have asked me that before, and the problem about it is that all I worry about is if I did get involved, I get compromised immediately.
In what way?
Well, because I'm having to kind of adopt party lines, and I'm not a party person in that sense. I'm an, I believe in the group, but I'm also an individualist, so that is, it's a balancing act, between the two. Otherwise, you get to one extreme over the other, whereas you get to a 1984 situation, where you're following Big Brother, and what Big Brother says is all, and I don't believe in that. But at the same time, I do believe that we should have proper governance. We don't.
No, you're right. No, we don't. I mean, it's not felt stable for a long, long time, has it? Not arguing about.
Well, not since, it's not felt stable since... Probably, I would say the early 2000s. Mm. It's certainly not been stable.
Yeah. So, I mean, everything that's happened since then, I mean, everything that's happened since 2015, 2016 just feels like we're on a wonk.
Yeah.
And I think we will feel now the repercussions of COVID for decades, potentially as a business owner. I know how I feel it and we feel it. And the worker from home back in the office.
Well, this is the other thing that we never take into account. We never take into account where we've arrived at, what we've done with ourselves. Mm. we sort of underestimate our own achievements, and we feel they've got to be new formed and new dished and new what, as opposed to taking something and developing it and making it work and getting it into the fabric of society. And we've never done that. We're constantly changing our hats. Oh, I'll wear this hat now. I'll put this hat on. You know, we don't actually think about how our children and how our children's children are going to inherit something and where that's going to go to. And also, it's part of our evolution. You know, it's part of our how we're evolving. And we keep being stupid. But also, we are stupid.
Well, I love the saying, the wise man plants the seed of a tree whose shade he knows he'll never sit under. So it's a real generational concept of what I do now matters for the future. You know, that, both for the immediate future, but also, you know, as I say, generationally. And perhaps everything is just so short-termist right now. That's the thing. It's, as you said about COVID, it's like, oh, let's do this now. And then, oh, that wasn't right. Let's do this now. That wasn't right. There's no long-term thinking.
And we live in such permanent confusion now. And that may be not a bad thing. Maybe that eventually we'll decide that we really do need clarity, mm-hmm. and clarity of purpose. And our clarity of purpose is somewhat non-existent.
Can I ask you a handful of quick-fire questions?
Sure.
Deadpool 3 next year. Are you going to be reprising your role as William Stryker?
I haven't heard about it, no.
You're not...
And I'm not available. When are they doing?
I mean, it's coming out next year, so I wasn't sure if you would have had anything to do with it.
No, I mean, I did Stryker, and then they did it again in Australia. And my friend Danny Houston played Stryker, and Danny's an old friend of mine, so I don't feel any... But I kept thinking,
why
did they not ask me? And I spoke to David Benioff about it, and... because he had done the original. He didn't do the final script, but he did the original script. So I don't know. So when these things finish, I tend to let go of them. I don't dwell on anything.
That's a good way of doing it.
No, I don't dwell on anything. You know, I mean, if they want to do it with another side, it's their business.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be busy anyway next year, so I won't have time to do anything. You know, as it is, I've got to look at stuff, and I'm saying, you know, they're offering me a lot of money to do certain things, and I can't do it. I'm just saying, nope, I'm tied up, because I'm doing what I want to do, you know. What I feel I should do, and as much as what I want to do, but I'm still nervous about that.
You've been a voice actor in a few video games, including Manhunt. Have you played many video games?
I never played them.
You never played them?
No.
So you never kind of heard yourself? Because I know you don't watch yourself.
No. Yeah. No desire to.
Have you still not watched the final episodes of Succession?
No, I haven't seen them. I saw the funeral.
You saw the funeral one.
Yeah, and that seemed rather good, but...
Fantastic episode.
Yeah, but I've never seen it. Yeah.
My friend Mike is convinced you'd be best friends. He's 72. He's watched you in pretty much everything. I told him I was coming to see you, and he said, can you ask a question? And it was just about favourite projects you've worked on.
Well, the favourite projects I work on, I don't think your friend Mike would ever have seen unless he goes to Stratford-upon-Avon, which isn't far from Gloucester. And my most favourite project was when I did Titus Andronicus. And I did that in the mid-80s, and it was a play that nobody ever would go
87,
near.
And you got the Olivier.
And I got the Olivier for it. But it was a wonderful project, and it's a wonderful play.
I watched you recreate, so I think with your son, it was a small group of actors.
Oh, yeah,
It
was quite a while ago I did that.
I'm just doing the research for this. You know, I watched you, you said, I don't know if I'm going to remember it. And then all of a sudden you remembered it all and performed fantastically. And I think everybody in the audience was like, what have we just watched?
Well, it was funny. I mean, I was a bit annoyed about that because it was an acting thing and I don't like demonstrating. I mean, you can demonstrate. I mean, I could demonstrate something, but you've got to make them do it, mm-hmm. not you demonstrating, because that just puts them in a kind of lower position. You know what
I understand.
So when they said, could you do a bit of Titus, and I wasn't happy about it. I said, no, I don't particularly want to do that because I don't like demonstrating something. But I was persuaded by the kids and everybody to do it, and so I just did it. You know?
I mean, I thought it was fantastic. So,
so that was a project. Of the films I've done, films I'm most proud of, probably is a film called The Escapist, which I did, which I produced as well as played in, and it was a film that was dear to my heart because I thought it was such a beautifully written script. And I kept a script in a, I kept it locked away because I knew that Rupert, who was trying to get it made, was going to all the world and his wife, and the world and his wife would give notes, and they always give notes on the scripts. And of course, they rapidly tried to take the writer away from his original intention. So I kept that script, and I said, this is the script we'll do. I mean, you can tell anybody any piece of shit you want, but this is what we'll do. And apart from changes, there were changes, naturally, it evolves. But it was basically the script we did. So that was one project that I was really proud of. And the other things is, you know, stuff that I've done.
I watched
certainly that. Certainly Logan is something I'm particularly proud of in the Succession, just simply because it was, in terms of the harmony of working with a group of people, there were so many, you know, we were all on the same page.
That was unique.
And then with Jesse Armstrong, when you work with a really great writer. And the other person, the other thing that I really love was Deadwood.
I love Deadwood,
and I love David Milch, you know. And you can tell your friend Mike, it's about the people you work with. It's about the people you inspire, inspires you. And Milch to me is a bit of a genius, you know, and that was such an extraordinary piece of work, Deadwood. And it's a shame that it didn't go on, but then they both, Milch and I can't remember the guy's name, but he ran HBO, they got into a pissing contest.
Right.
And it was a Jewish pissing contest, which is the worst pissing contest it could be. So, and they just, then David just took his ball and said, right, I'm taking it home, but nobody's playing with it. And that was a shame because we were all lined up to go back.
I did some acting classes a few years ago now, and the acting coach, the first thing he said was, go watch Deadwood. He said, you know, that is, it's a masterclass. You know, kind of left to right.
No, it was fantastic. And it was wonderful to work with McShane,
he's fantastic, isn't he?
He was just astonishing in the show. Absolutely astonishing. So that was something I prized. Mm. Yeah.
The laws in the US have changed massively in regards to cannabis. You've talked about smoking and how you didn't smoke until you were 50, I think is right. Do you think those laws have gone far enough across the country? How do you feel about those
laws? I still think you've got to be careful with that. You know, I mean, I think you've got to be careful with that. You know, you don't get them too young. I mean, I started smoking when I was 50 because I needed to find a way of relaxing, you know, that, and it does relax me. And at the end of an evening, you know, if I feel it, I will. Usually it's more stressful back home than it is here because now I don't need it so much in the same way. I had a puff last night. You know, I had a puff last night, but I haven't had a puff since I've been here. So that was pretty good of me to just sit down and have a puff. And also, you've just got to watch how much you smoke because there's a point where it goes into sort of silliness where you have to really monitor yourself as you're smoking.
Yeah.
But I do believe in it. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's not particularly wonderful for the lungs, but my lungs are not too bad.
And you said you're quite fit, so do you exercise quite a bit?
I do when I can. I'm probably going to go to the gym after this, which is why I've got my gym going.
Yeah.
I'm still for it, you know. And there are the gummy situation is rather good. The gummies are also a very good way of getting it. It does take a while to work. It takes that much longer to kick in.
So for you, it's just a relaxation.
It is a relaxation. It's a relaxation, and it's just to go into another zone where I don't have to, you know, and I can be silly.
And drink was never something you turned to for that?
No, drink is, I mean, look at it. I have all that stuff up there, and it's untouched. Yeah. And it will remain. I mean, I get stuff all the time.
It's a good gift. It's a nice gift.
Yeah, well, my eldest son, he always drinks my Lagavulin, which is the whiskey I used to drink. But I don't drink that so much now. And ironically, the thing I like now is tequila.
Ah, okay.
Because it's agave-based, it's slightly... I'm diabetic, so I have to watch it anyway.
Okay.
And it's slightly better for you. I mean, I say that. It's probably bollocks, actually.
It's the stories we tell ourselves, Brian.
It's the story we tell ourselves. Oh, it's tequila is much better than out and whiskey.
Yeah.
But it's still alcohol, you know.
Well, the Rock's got his tequila brand, doesn't he? Terramano.
And then George Clooney has a tequila count.
Of course.
Here's a tequila. But I do like, I like the margaritas. I used to do it years and years ago, and I've started it again now. I like it.
It's just everything in balance, isn't it? And I think that's
it is. I mean, you know, and it's what I do in the privacy of my own space. I never go. I mean, I don't like pubs. I've never liked pub culture. No, I hate pubs.
Is that the laddishness of it, though?
Yeah, I can't be dealing with all that. Yeah, you know, all those horrible lads together. You know, I've never liked pubs. We were in Bath, and after the show, people would go to the pub, and it was my idea of hell. I just thought, oh, no, I don't want to do that.
How do you like Bath?
I love Bath. I loved it. It's the most stunning city, and just constant surprise to me. I mean, and then going to the Roman Baths, the sense of history, the sense of, you know, the Mary Shelley, you know, Jane Austen, all of that, and that sense of continuum, and also the Roman baths are just astonishing. Just astonishing. No, I love Bath. It reminds me a lot of Edinburgh, actually. Has that sense of timelessness and beautiful. The way the structure of the city is just stunning. And then the highlight when you go out and you look back at the city. I loved Bath, and it was a great, great time. And my wife was with me, so we had a great time.
Yeah, of course.
Again.
And you acted together.
Yeah,
right?
It was great to be together. And
how was that working together?
I love working with my wife. She's a great actress, and we had a great time. And unfortunately, the scenes were just quite small scenes, but they were very key, you know, particularly kicking the play off. The first scene was between us, so it got off to a good start.
Thank you very much for your time, Brad.
You're welcome.
Genuinely really, really enjoyed it. And I'm not going to tell you to tell me to fuck off, don't worry.
No chance. No way I will.
Thank you.
And that was the Starting Line podcast with me, Rich Lee, and the wonderful Brian Cox. He had a few things to say, didn't he? Thank you so much for listening, watching. Thank you for any and all love you might give this. So reviews, comments, anything just to help other people see this. You know, there are algorithms at play and all that jazz that, you know, I could pretend to understand, but really, does anybody understand? Probably Mr. Beast, right? Says this 36-year-old. If you can go find us, follow on social media, that's Starting Line Show on pretty much all of them, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and Starting Line Podcast on Facebook and LinkedIn, then that will be very, very helpful. Help get us out there. Subscribe. Apparently, it's something that most people don't do when they listen. I can't remember the stats for it, but the majority of people that watch or listen won't then subscribe, but enjoyed it. I think that's everything. Do you know, I feel a bit out of practice. It's been a good few months since I've done these intros and outros. And again, this is the first time using video. So I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed making it for you. And I want to keep doing this. So again, if you want to get in touch, hello@startinglinepod.com. Find out more about me and the show, startinglinepod.com. And see you very soon. Goodbye. Forever.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, Visit stripe.com/tapiphone.